Hello, and welcome to this concise presentation on the need for comprehensive pain education. This program is provided by Clinical Care Options in partnership with the American Academy of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, the AAPMNR, Practicing Clinicians Exchange, and ProCE. It is supported by an independent educational grant from the Opioid Analgesic REMS Program Companies. I'm Dr. Eric Shaw, Chair of the AAPMNR Opioid Task Force, Medical Director of the Shepherd Spine and Pain Institute here in Atlanta, Georgia. Here are the objectives that we're going to be discussing today. We're going to talk about the types of pain, the basic physiology of pain, the transformation from acute to chronic pain, the overview of treatment options. You know, it's really more than just giving patients medication. We're going to talk about interdisciplinary pain treatment and what's involved with that and the evidence behind it. The importance of treating pain, and the knowledge of how to do it properly. We're going to introduce the educational series, Expert Guidance for Effective Pain Management and Appropriate Monitoring of Patients with Pain. This is what we're all about and hope you'll get a lot out of this series. This is the different types of pain. Nociceptive or inflammatory, that involves joints, muscles, can involve the abdomen and viscera as well. Neuropathic pain, which is a damage to the nervous system, the peripheral or the central. And then there's central sensitization, otherwise known as nociplastic pain. So there's a stimulus, the neurons are involved, and the different neurons involved depending upon the pain state, the site of where the neurons are firing, the clinical setting that you might see this in, how the function is affected of the patient, as well as the sensitivity. Right. So nociceptive pain, let's take arthritis, for example, typically has a moderate to higher threshold to kind of elicit the pain, whereas neuropathic and central sensitization or nociplastic pain has a lower threshold and so on. So there are quite a different range of pain states and pain presentations that you'll see across the population. And there are different degrees of psychological impact that it will have on the human being. And we'll talk about all those during this series. And I'm hopeful that you'll learn a lot and it will enhance and improve your practice. So let's talk about why pain is good. It's an important sensory signal. It's protective and helps survival. And this has evolved over thousands and tens of thousands of years or longer. It's a warning signal about threat or injury. It can prevent further injury. You break your ankle, you want to keep walking on it. It can give a signal to limit activity, to allow healing. And it urges a person to seek treatment. So these are the positive aspects of pain and how they serve a positive benefit for the organism. So we're going to talk about briefly the pain pathway. Okay, there's an injury or damage somewhere in the system. The C fiber, unmyelinated, right? So slower transmission, you know, usually 100 milliseconds or maybe a little more. And it elicits a sympathetic reaction. That's tachypnea, rapid heart rate, rapid breathing, tachycardia, rapid heart rate, anxiety, a little stress, right? Pallor can lead to some sweating, diaphoresis, and pupillary dilation with the release of adrenaline. Let's talk briefly about the pain physiology and the signal and the actual pathway, okay? So there's a signal. Let's say you stub your toe. This is going to send pain along the L5 nerve root up through the tissues in the toe. It's going to be transducted. That's the converting the mechanical stimulus into an electrical signal. It's going to be then transmitted along the peripheral nerve to the DRG, the dorsal root ganglia, which is located on the spinal nerve root at the neural foramina or just proximal to it. Okay. Processing is then modulated within the spinal cord. It can be either inhibited by descending inhibitory pathways or amplified. Okay. And then it ascends to the brain through second and third order neurons into the cortex to make the human being aware of the pain. Over time, of course, there's maladaptive neural plasticity or processing that leads to the chronic pain phenomenon. So within that chronic pain phenomenon, there's a hypothalamic pituitary axis disorders that can be altered that lead to chronic pain, can lead to lack of proper sleep, and also with depression and fatigue. And these are hallmarks of chronic pain. There can be reduced levels of MHPG, DHEA, and beta endorphins that can predict higher levels of disability, and the genetic factors that can also play a role in chronic pain. So when pain lasts for longer than it's useful to protect and serve as a warning to the human being, then it's considered chronic. And that's typically over 3 months. It can create a significant psychological burden, has an internal and external impact, right? So it affects the human being with depression and limited activity, but it can also affect relationships, work, and other things. There's complex neurobiologic circuitry that's affected, and ultimately it's a decrease in overall function for the person. Here's some brief definitions from the International Association for the Study of Pain. Chronic pain is pain that recurs or persists for longer than 3 months. Cancer-related is pain due to cancer or its treatment. Chronic post-surgical pain or post-traumatic pain is pain that develops or increases in intensity after tissue trauma, surgical or accidental, and persists beyond 3 months. Chronic neuropathic pain is also lesion of the somatosensory or central nervous system. Chronic secondary headache or orofacial pain, and chronic forms, symptomatic headaches, chronic dental pain can be in this section too. Chronic secondary visceral pain after underlying conditions such as pancreatitis, the internal organs or head and neck, the thoracic, abdominal, and pelvic regions can also be caused by persistent inflammation and vascular mechanisms and also mechanical factors. Chronic secondary musculoskeletal pain, pain in bones and joints, tendons arising from underlying disease, can be due to persistent inflammation associated with structural changes or caused by altered biomechanical function, also due to diseases of the central nervous system. So when we assess somebody with chronic pain, we want to do a thorough history and physical exam. We want to know how did it start, what changes in the person's life have occurred, what medications and treatments they've tried, and when was the last time they had any appropriate treatment or relief, and how this has affected their life overall. So if there's a red flag, such as a radiculopathy with loss of strength, reflexes, and anesthesia in that dermatome, you might want to get some MRI, or at least an X-ray. And myelopathy, of course, compression of the spinal cord within the cervical or thoracic spine would lead to weakness, increased reflexes, and perhaps bowel and bladder dysfunction. And that would be a pretty urgent need to get an MRI. So physical therapy is tantamount to maintaining function and keeping a patient active. So passive modalities like heat and ice, patient can do at home. Specialized treatment they can only get with a trained physical therapist with more expensive equipment in the gym can be ultrasound. Diathermy is another way to provide deep heat. This is typically used in Europe, not so much in the US. Active exercise program in a controlled way to let the patient know it's okay to move like this. You're not hurting yourself any further. That enables the patient to overcome fear they typically avoid in chronic pain situations. Dry needling can be very helpful for myofascial pain. And isometric, concentric, or eccentric muscle strengthening exercises can be important depending upon the actual problem that we're trying to treat. Now we're going to talk about the pharmacologic management with chronic pain. These are just some of the basics. Acetaminophen, of course, we need to be careful about not exceeding 3 grams or 3,000 milligrams a day for the concern for hepatotoxicity for chronic use. NSAIDs, which of course can cause GI toxicity and GI bleeding, nephrotoxicity, hepatotoxicity, and there's a black box warning from the FDA about cerebrovascular and cardiovascular events such as stroke and heart attack. So even though these are commonly used and promoted as first-line agents, they're not as benign, especially for older folks, and need to be used with caution. SSRIs such as citalopram and sertraline, and NSRIs like venlafaxine and duloxetine can be very helpful. These can cause sedation, can cause weight gain, and have other various side effects, but typically can be helpful and useful when used appropriately. They do take a few weeks for full onset of efficacy, so it's important to counsel patients that there takes a little bit of time to see the full impact. Tricyclic antidepressants can be used for sleep, such as imipramine, nortriptyline, and amitriptyline. These can cause postural hypotension, and as well as anticholinergic side effects such as urinary retention and dry mouth, and should be used accordingly with care. Gabapentinoids such as gabapentin and pregabalin can be very helpful, especially for neuropathic pain, but can be limited with weight gain and swelling as well as sedation. And antispasmodics such as tizanidine, cyclobenzaprine, and baclofen can be helpful, but also certainly cause sleepiness. Opiates should be used with caution, with a focus on increased function and quality of life, with care for risk management. And they can carry certain risks such as sedation, headache, constipation, and others, and should also be used with caution. These include hydrocodone, morphine, fentanyl, oxycodone, hydromorphone, buprenorphine, tapentadol, tramadol, etc. So all of these medications can be used in concert as long as you're taking care to balance out the risks of each one and use them in a complementary fashion with modest to low doses, and keep aware of the patient's mixed pharmacology and look out for side effects with current and ongoing treatment. In terms of injection options, we can use epidural steroid injections, facet and medial branch blocks, trigger point injections, joint injections, nerve injections, and the list really, I don't want to say is infinite, but it's quite extensive with a trained expert. And so there's lots of options that should be tailored to the specific needs of the patient and not done routinely for the same presentation over and over and over again, as every patient has a unique set of problems and their program and their treatment paradigm structured specifically for their needs. So let's talk about overall treatment for pain management, for chronic pain. Interdisciplinary treatment is really the hallmark, what we should all be striving to do, whether we can achieve that or not. So that's the physician, a psychologist, physical therapist, and the nursing team interact on patients to help make decisions with everyone's input, because everyone's going to see a different aspect of the patient and their problem, whether it's psychological, physical, and how they're progressing or not. And they can all give valid input to help make the decision and make the care better. It's very time consuming for sure. And you need a whole team, which may not be feasible depending upon the practice setting. So the clinician should attempt to practice this way as often as possible and involve as many members of the team as practical on an ongoing basis. The psychological aspects of chronic pain are quite devastating, can lead to isolation, life dysfunction. Patients can lose jobs, family, as well as spousal relationships, and certainly income is devastating with the loss of a job. And this can lead to all sorts of stress in terms of money, living situations, and just paying your regular bills. Pain treatment is vital. According to the CDC, almost just over 20% of U.S. adults have chronic pain, and 8% or perhaps higher have a high impact chronic pain affecting life and work. This costs billions of dollars annually. Effective, thoughtful pain management can make a real difference. The use of a team approach and evidence-based medicine where applicable will improve the likelihood of success. Now, please, the Institute of Medicine has stated, despite the large role that care of patients with pain will play in their daily practice, many health professionals, especially physicians, appear underprepared for and uncomfortable with carrying out the aspect of their work. These professionals need and deserve a greater knowledge and skills so they can contribute to the necessary cultural transformation in the perception and treatment of people with pain. What this is speaking to is the stigmatization of patients with chronic pain and the fact that almost every practitioner, regardless of specialty, will experience a patient with pain. These practitioners don't necessarily have all the skills and tools an understanding of what pain is, especially chronic pain, and how to best treat it. It does not mean opioids. There's lots of other ways to treat chronic pain, and physicians shouldn't shy away from it just because the patient has a chronic condition. There are lots of ways to treat it that can be very effective without the use of opioids. All right, so we're going to be introducing the expert guidance for effective management and appropriate monitoring of patients with pain. It's a multimodal approach by clinical care options in partnership with the AAPMNR, Practicing Clinicians Exchange, and ProCE. It's designed for the entire healthcare team. That's physicians, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, nursing, and case management. Learning objectives for the program, we're looking to define the fundamental concepts of pain management, including the mechanisms of pain, risk factors for abuse and addiction, and appropriate assessment of pain. We want to teach you guys how to safely and effectively integrate the range of therapeutic options for managing pain into an individualized patient-specific pain treatment plan, including initiating therapy, titrating, and discontinuation of opioid analgesics where appropriate. We want to demonstrate the effectiveness of counseling patients and caregivers on the safe use of opioids and naloxone for opioid overdose. We want to identify and appropriately manage patients with opioid use disorder. We're going to be covering all of these topics: pain assessment, fundamentals, therapeutic options, effective treatment plans, managing patients on opioids, safe use of opioids, patient education, when to refer to a pain specialist, addiction medicine, and opiate use disorder. So all of these, I think, will be fascinating and hopefully educational for everybody listening. All right. So to sum up, chronic pain is very common in the United States, with 8%+ of patients, adults, experiencing high-impact chronic pain. Effective, thoughtful pain management can make a big difference in patients' lives, but many healthcare professionals are underprepared or an uncomfortable dealing with chronic pain. Our program, Expert Guidance for Effective Pain Management and Appropriate Monitoring of Patients with Pain, is designed to help. Watch this space for further educational opportunities. Thank you.